Hey, thank you for coming today. We're going to go ahead and get started with the book of Job. We are getting to kind of the climax of the book of Job. Today, after all this chit-chat from Job and all his friends and all manner of various human beings, we're going to hear God speak. So it's kind of the climax to the book that everyone remembers and thinks about. And the things that God is going to say, of course, are quite important. To this point, we've been hearing a lot of thoughts and speculations and disputes between Job and his three friends, and sometimes we know for sure which ones are right, and other times we kind of have to think about it a little bit. Of course, when God speaks, we know that what he's going to tell us is the truth and give us the perspective on the situation that we know is going to give us something solid to go with. We know is going to give us some firm answers for a change. So we're going to be taking a look at assortment of passages from Job 38 to 41 today. And then next week, we will have the conclusion of the Job class. We'll study chapter 42. It's kind of the closing to the story. We'll have 1 week between the class quarters, 2 weeks from today, which is the Sunday of Memorial Day weekend. We have a special speaker that we're bringing in all the way from Texas, a renowned moral philosopher from the Lone Star State will be regaling us with no doubt numerous tales of his experiences, as well as some Bible as well, in a couple of weeks. And then on the first Sunday in June, we'll be starting the study of Proverbs for the summertime. So just to give you an idea for what's coming up on the schedule. Lynn is going to go ahead and lead us in a short time of prayer in order to get ready to study, and then we'll tackle some Job. Amen. Thank you very much. Okay, Job chapter 38. Let's go ahead and go right into reading some of the things that God says after our long expectation of him. You know, in the movies, whenever they have the voice of God coming forth, they always get someone like Orson Welles to do it. And we don't really have Orson Welles around here, so I'm going to have to pick some people who are at least not overwhelmingly unlike Orson Welles to do it. So, Lloyd, you're not overwhelmingly unlike Orson Welles, and you don't need, unlike the others, you don't need a gallon of coffee to get going in the morning. So could you do some reading for us? Would you mind just go ahead and read not the whole of chapter 38, but up to verse 38, if you could?
Then the Lord answered out of the storm. He said, "Who is this that darkens my counsel with words without knowledge? Brace yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me. Where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? Tell me if you understand. Who marked off its dimensions? Surely you know. Who stretched a measuring line across it? On what were its footings set? Or who laid its cornerstone? While the morning stars sang together and all the angels shouted for joy. Who shut up the sea behind doors when it burst forth from the womb? When I made the clouds its garment and wrapped it in thick darkness. When I fixed limits for it and set its doors and bars in place. When I said, this far you may come and no further. Here is where your proud waves halt. Have you ever given orders to the morning or shown the dawn its place? That it might take the earth by the edges and shake the wicked out of it. The earth takes shape like clay under a seal. Its features stand out like those of a garment. The wicked are denied their right, and their upraised arm is broken. Have you journeyed to the springs of the sea, or walked in the recesses of the deep? Have the gates of death been shown to you?
Have you seen the gates of the shadow of death? Have you comprehended the vast expanses of the earth? Tell me if you know all this. What is the way to the abode of light? And where does darkness reside? Can you take them to their places? Do you know the paths or their dwellings? Surely you know, for you were already born. You have lived so many years. Have you entered the storehouses of the snow, or seen the storehouses of the hail, which I reserve for times of trouble, for days of war and battle? What is the way to the place where the lightning is dispersed, or the place where the east winds are scattered over the earth? Who cuts a channel for the torrents of rain and a path for the thunderstorm? To water a land that no man lives, a desert with no one in it, to satisfy a desolate wasteland and make it sprout with grass? Does the rain have a father? Who fathers the drops of dew? From whose womb comes the ice? Who gives birth to the frost from the heavens when the waters become hard as stone, when the surface of the deep is frozen? Can you bind the beautiful Pleiades? Can you loose the cords of Orion? Can you bring forth the constellations in their season, or lead out the bear to its cub? Do you know the laws of the heavens? Can you set up God's dominion over the earth? Can you raise your voice to the clouds and cover yourself with a flood of water? Do you send the lightning bolts on their way? Do they report to you, "Here we are"? Who endowed the heart with wisdom, or gave understanding to the mind? Who has the wisdom to count the clouds? Who can tip over the water jars of the heavens when the cloud dust becomes hard, when the dust becomes hard and the clods of earth stick together?
Thank you very much. That's very good. This is God finally speaking after all the chit-chat that's been going on amongst all the human characters. And he talks to Job out of the storm. It's kind of a perfect metaphor, because there's no mention necessarily of a physical storm, but the storm that Job is going through. And some commentators have imagined that there may have been a sudden thunderstorm, which is kind of the, at least what they do in movies when God is going to speak. And then they have God's powerful voice booming out there. And so God speaks out of the storm and he talks to Job. And there's a lot of things that are very interesting about this. The first thing that you really notice is that when God deals with Job, he's going to talk directly to him personally. And this is what Job's wanted all along. What Job is going to get from God is something very personal. And God shows him firm respect. He does not belittle Job. He doesn't talk down to him. He doesn't demean him. And at the same time, God is going to be very clear and very direct and very straightforward with what he teaches him. And it's a good basic point to remember with all the other things God says and in your own interactions with God, that this is the way God treats us. God is our Father. He's our Heavenly Father. He is perfect in his knowledge. He is perfect in what he does. He also has tremendous compassion for us. And he loves us and he wants that personal interaction with us. He's not interested in just bossing us around or in making us feel bad. He is interested in us understanding. He shows us that great outpouring of grace. As Jesus said to the apostles, I'm not going to call you my servants because a servant doesn't know his master's business. I'm going to call you my friends because I'm going to explain it to you. And this is what God has always been interested in. So he starts talking then about the creation. And this is the great theme of a large part of this speech on God's part. And he starts by talking about what's really the form and the structure of creation. In a little bit, he's going to talk about the living things in creation. He starts by just talking about the basic form and structure. Now, see how much you picked up there. What are some of the specific aspects of creation that God has mentioned in this first passage?
Foundations.
In other words, that we never really think of the creation as being founded on something, but somehow it all kind of fits together and it doesn't just fall apart, it doesn't just fall down. There's at least metaphorically, there's a foundation to it that God had to be responsible for.
That makes me think about a couple of weeks ago, there was a verse that we just went right on by it, but it said he hangs the earth on nothing.
So,
talking about?
So it, right, it's a very interesting metaphor.
How did Job know that?
hangs on nothing. In a sense, the earth is just, as the astronomers tell us, spinning around, and it's spinning around these other objects that are themselves spinning around. And it's a fascinating thing to think about, the divine design that went into that, the divine power that goes into that.
The seas have boundaries.
Okay, so he talks about setting boundaries. And it's kind of a metaphor because in reality, the earth is mostly water. So what really has boundaries? The continents really have the boundaries. But he's talking about it from his point of view, because human life is on the continents. From his point of view, he limits the seas so that they don't just swallow everything up and force us to evolve a lot more quickly than even the evolutionists think we can evolve to swim around and have gills. What did you notice, Norma?
He noted that it wasn't done haphazardly.
That's an important aspect of it, is the care that went into it. And that's one of the things that he's emphasizing to Job, is not just knowledge as in factual knowledge, but care and planning and thought went into it. That it's a very careful creation that he put together here.
Amen.
We'll try to rebut that a little bit later on here. We'll work on that. That's in a sense it's true. In a very narrow, self-interested sense, yes, it is certainly true. God is certainly very good at those kind of things. You'll also notice he talks about natural phenomenon. He has this metaphor. He asks, talks to Job about the storehouses of snow and hail. And of course, that's another figurative expression. There is no such thing as a storehouse of hail sitting up there someplace. It's figurative. It's talking about how God has the whole thing put together. Everything is in its place. And everything in the natural world functions exactly the way that God wanted it to. And the thing that he's trying to get across to Job is more than just a static creation. And it's something good for us to think about too, because we are very much in the habit of quoting facts about the creation that simply prove that God exists. But God isn't interested in just sitting there and existing. God is interested in living and us understanding that he lives and that his presence pervades his creation. And this is what he's getting across to Job. And one thing about the thing that God is going to do is we're going to continue here. He talks about some more things about the creation. It's helpful to remember that God is answering Job. It's not necessarily a one-size-fits-all. The points that he makes to Job will be valid for everybody. The way he does it in such a way that Job is going to find it very satisfying. Job is going to say, yes, I understand this, even though Job is not going to get his specific questions answered. God is never going to tell him, you did this and that's why I slapped you around. God's never even going to tell him about that little conversation with Satan. He's not even going to mention that. He's just going to stress to Job, Job, I'm here, I understand, you can always talk to me, you can always find me. And Job's going to realize, yeah, you know, that's what I needed. It's not what Job expected. Job did not expect for God to talk about the creation and the animals and so forth. Job expected something much different, much more forensic. But when Job got the answer that God gave him, he was satisfied with it. And so it's not a one-size-fits-all. God is going to use this imagery because he knows Job is going to understand it. There's a one commentator that I read who's quite sarcastic and yet accurate in this case. He said, you can't cure every instance of discouragement and depression by telling someone to look at hippopotamus. You know, it just doesn't work. Now, for me, it might work, depending on how deep the depression was. It wouldn't always work even for me. Now, penguins, yeah, penguins would probably always work. I can't be depressed if I'm looking at penguins. Ducks, yeah, 99% of the time. Hippo, maybe about 50% of the time. My affection for hippopotamus is slightly less than my affection for penguins. To Job, it works great. And this is the thing to remember, is that we do have a tendency to want the one-size-fits-all answers. Oh, Christian X is going through situation number 33. Let's look up verse number 33, solution number 33 in the Christian manual. Here, look at a hippopotamus. You feel better now? Well, God is not doing that. And even though the flesh may be disappointed, there's not a one-size-fits-all answer to depression in the Bible? Oh, that's disappointing. In a sense, it's better. Your soul appreciates it more, because what your soul appreciates is the fact that God took the time to meet Job where Job was at and to think about what Job would need and what Job would benefit from. And so when we continue, that's the thing to remember, is that that's what God is doing. Let's pick up in chapter 38, verse 39, and this is a passage. This is one of the great passages in Job. So I need people I can trust to read this. So that lets out most of you characters, and in particular, it lets out the engineers. So, Dot, I will hope that you will be able to read some things for us. You're one of the people I can trust on passages like this. Could you go from chapter 38, verse 38, and go up to chapter 39, verse 18? And then, Tanya, could you continue from there with chapter 39, verse 19, down to the end of chapter 30? And I know I've got some people I can trust working on this one, and you will notice right away why these passages need to be read by people I can trust. For Dot, for 38, Dot's, yeah, I'm going to have Dot and Tanya read it. Yeah, if you can start at 38, 39. That's okay. I'll save a good one for you. You're fairly reliable, too. Why don't you start from 39, 19? Hey, they're worth the trouble. The rest of you characters, if you gave me this kind of trouble, I'd take away your verses, but these two are worth the trouble.
Dwelleth and abideth on the rock, upon the crag of the rock, and the sound place. From thence she seeketh the prey, and her eyes behold afar off. Her young ones also suck up blood, and where the slain are, there is she.
Very good. Thank you very much. This all has a common theme, doesn't it? God is showing Job all the different animals that he has created, and as he does this, it's implicit that there are many, many more out there. You know, there are thousands upon thousands of outstanding animal species that are not mentioned in this passage. And each one of these actually has a particular point to it, though. It's not simply saying, Job, look, I made all this stuff, straighten up and let me tell you what to do. That's not at all the point. It's certainly the way some commentators interpret it, but that's not at all what the point is. God is using examples that he knows will mean something to Job, and most of them I'd be happy with. Some of you would have preferred some more technical explanation of things. But all of these have points involved in their relationship with God. You know, for example, this first group of animals in those first few verses, he mentions lions, ravens, goats, and deer. Now, for those of you who know a little bit about animals, what do all those animals have in common? They have certain things in common that you could find two or three of these. It's kind of a trick question. They have nothing in common except that God takes care of them. That's what that passage is about. He says God is meeting their needs. He talks about he meets the needs of the lioness with her cubs, make sure they find something to eat. He meets the needs for the prey, for the ravens, make sure they have something to scavenge on. He makes sure that these animals have a place to bring forth their young when they need it. So God meets their needs and he protects them. That's what they have in common. And God is saying to Job, not just, look, I made all this stuff. He's saying, I made all this stuff and I take care of it. I take real good care of it. You know, one of my wife's favorite scriptures in Matthew 6. You know, we have these scriptures that we know, you know, from Romans 1, that tells us that God made everything and it's clear from what he has been made. And that's another one we like to use to smack atheists around with. But it doesn't just say we know God exists. It says we know his qualities from what has been made. The creation is not just there as a club to beat atheists with. It's a teaching for us that you can learn a lot of things from it. Hebrews 11 tells that we have faith that God created everything, and therefore we understand some of the qualities of God that go with that. Well, Matthew 6:30 is the passage that says, you know, if God's going to take care of the animals and the plants, how much more is he going to take care of you, oh, you of little faith? And this is what he's telling Job. He's using something that he knows Job will understand. Likewise, with the wild donkeys and the oxen, if donkeys and oxen, especially today, what kind of animals do we consider those? We consider those domesticated animals, work animals. You know, that they're supposed to do our work for us. But in the passage, what kind is God talking about?
Wild ones.
Wild ones. In other words, what is he telling Job? Yeah, I actually made those things to have their own identity, their own lives. It's an act of grace that I allow you to tame some of them and use them for your needs. And this is another good passage, Psalm chapter 8, where it talks about, when I consider the heavens and the work of your hands, what is humanity that you're mindful of us and that you put us over the work of your hands? It's something that, while we're so busy using creation to prove that God exists to atheists, we don't realize, yet God really is an extremely indulgent father to let us play with his toys, to let us use and more often abuse and misuse the creation he has without slapping us around as we deserve for the ways that we distort and abuse the things he's made. God is very compassionate and gracious in that. And it's something he's reminding Job, you know, when you use creation, whether it's your domesticated animals, whether it's the crops you plant, remember where it comes from. It's me taking care of you. I don't have to do that. I could make you figure out how to create animals and plants yourself if you want to feed yourself. Or I could have made feeding something very painful and difficult for you to do instead of making it something that I've provided for you. So God is using these illustrations that Job will understand. And if it were someone else, if it were an engineer, he'd probably use a different way. And this is, you can illustrate this in a number of ways. I remember not long ago, last year, I was at a baseball game with Phil, because we have this cultural exchange program. You know, once a year or so, I go to a basketball with Phil. Once a year or so, he comes to a baseball game with me. Well, we were at this baseball game last year, and he looks over at my scorecard, and he looks at the other team's lineup. And he says, hey, look, this is interesting. That other team has a guy on their team named Stock, and they have another guy on their team named Cash. And isn't this guy's first name Rich? So insight into how the engineering mind works there. Yeah, either that or he's been hanging around with doctors too much. We'll have to figure out that a little bit later. Now, on the other hand, see, I never would have noticed that. I knew this. I'd seen this other team. I knew the players' names. I never made that connection. On the other hand, I was at a game earlier this season when the team the Buckeyes were playing had a left fielder named Wren and a third baseman named Dove. And I picked up that very quickly. I noticed that the moment that they read off the lineup. So God knows what we can relate to. So if it were me, God would talk very similarly to what he does to Job. If it were someone else, he would use something else. So you can't necessarily use the exact images as a one-size-fits-all. It's the points that God's making that are important. The ostrich that he mentions next is a very funny animal. It's an animal that if you watch them and if you look at nature shows about them, they're really funny. They're hilarious. And they also have a lot of strange habits that people misunderstand. You know, there's that old myth about the ostrich burying its head in the sand. It doesn't do any such thing. It's not that stupid. It has a couple of habits that people misinterpret for that. The ostrich has incredible eyesight, which was covered in a trivia question last year, for those of you who weren't here for it. It also has a habit when it sees something, it likes to get to hear, and it stretches out in a very funny way and sticks its head on the ground to hear and to sense what kind of footprints that's coming at a distance. And a long time ago, people started misinterpreting that. Oh, it's burying its head in the sand. What a silly creature. No, it's a very alert creature. It's a very creature who's very sensitive to its surroundings. Back in Job's time, there was another misconception about the ostrich, because the ostrich, because it's kind of ungainly and funny, has a funny build, it can only lay its eggs on the ground. It can't climb up in a tree or anything like that. So it finds a warm place in the sand, it lays its eggs there. And it's kind of a hazardous place for birds' eggs to be. They also have a habit, if a lion or another predator comes near, what the adult ostriches will do is they'll just bolt off in different directions. And a long time ago, people thought, well, those ostriches don't care about their eggs, do they? They don't care about their young. Well, in reality, what are they doing? They're distracting the predator. Ducks do the same thing. Male ducks during nesting season, you'll always see a bunch of male ducks splashing around and making a lot of ruckus. And it looks like those slacker male ducks, you know, they're letting the mommy sit on the eggs. Well, in reality, what they're doing is they're providing an easy target for any predators that come in. Any predators that come in, they want the predators to think, those dumb ducks, they're just entrees waiting for us, and they never think about hunting for the eggs. Well, the thing that he says about the ostrich is that the ostrich is maligned, it's misunderstood, it's funny, but you know what? God loves it. And you know what? The ostrich doesn't really care what people think about it. That's what these verses have said. Ostrich just chuckles at the rest of us, just chuckles at the horse and rider that thinks they're so magnificent. The ostrich is enjoying life because it knows that God loves it. And what he's saying is, Job, if you feel you're an outcast, if you feel you're misunderstood by humans, if you feel like you don't fit in, it doesn't matter because I love you just as much. I don't care what the other people think about you. And it's kind of a reassurance to Job in his feelings of not being in tune with his own friends misunderstand him and everything. So the ostrich is a bird that just illustrates God's love for everything. God loves the things that we think are the silliest or the most useless. Likewise with the horse, it's an interesting thing, and it's very fanciful. It talks about this horse who's being put to work by these humans. And the humans, again, they feel proud of themselves because they've domesticated the horse. But his imagery here is talking about the horse actually is enjoying this. He's getting some excitement and some adventure. So he's kind of saying, who's the master here? Are you humans getting useful work out of the horse? Or is the horse smart enough to know that if it hangs around with humans, it can get some excitement in his life a little bit? And he's kind of just saying to Job, things aren't quite as simple as you think sometimes. Sometimes different stuff is going on. The hawk and the eagle, this is a little bit more easy, I think, to understand. Hawks and eagles, what's the image that he gives of them? Soaring and flying where? Way up in the air. The hawks and the eagles soar way up in the air, soar long distances. They see more than just about any creature does. And he's comparing them to his own perspective, because that's the way that God looks at things. And of course, to God, even the lofty vantage point of a hawk or an eagle is pretty trivial. and pretty narrow and pretty limited. And so he's just reminding Job of how much more that he can see than Job realizes. And so it's kind of a reassurance that's perfect for Job. And as we get back into the text here, picking up in chapter 40, God kind of pauses in the middle of his talk to talk directly with Job and to give him a little bit of kind of personal perspective. And God never accuses Job of any sin. He never belittles Job. He does speak firmly to him. Job has said some things because he's kind of overreacted to his friends. And God wants to make sure that Job realizes to keep their relationship on the proper ground. So God gives a kind of more of a direct answer to Job here in the first few verses. He says, "The Lord said to Job, 'Will the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? Let him who accuses God answer him.' And then Job answered the Lord, 'I am unworthy. How can I reply to you? I put my hand over my mouth. I spoke once, but I have no answer. Twice, but I will say no more.'" So Job is saying, basically, yeah, I get it. I get what you're saying here. And later, next week, we'll look where Job talks a little bit more with his reactions. Even though Job never got his actual questions answered, and he's got something that's very different from what he expected, he's getting the thing that he needed. This is the thing about God. When you are troubled by something, whether it's depression in your life or just things you don't understand about God, God will give you what you need. And as long as you're listening for it, He'll be there. It might not be what you expect. See, Job kind of expected that God would go through and analyze all the events. Instead, God's talking about ostriches and horses, but Job understands what God is telling him. And he goes on here to say to Job, he tells Job some things that Job, it's important for Job to understand. In verse 6, "The Lord spoke to Job out of the storm, 'Brace yourself like a man, I'll question you, and you shall answer me. Would you discredit my justice? Would you condemn me to justify yourself?'" And this is not, again, it's not attacking Job. He is giving Job a loving correction. He's saying, "Job, you know, you did ask a lot of these questions, wondering where I was, wondering if I didn't care about you, wondering if I left you, wondering if you were suffering unfairly. You don't need to condemn me to justify yourself. I never condemned you, Job. I never said that it was for your sin. I never told you I was punishing you. But you don't have to condemn me to justify yourself. You don't have to question me in order to justify yourself." And, you know, there's a lot of applications to that, because one of the things you learn from Job is that it's legitimate to ask the tough questions. God does not mind that at all. God can take it. If you want to ask God, "God, why do you allow so much of the violence and sadness and hatred in the world?" God is more than happy to talk to you about it. You don't have to question God in order to make yourself look good. See, a lot of people will criticize God in order to make themselves look good, or they'll criticize someone else in order to make themselves look good. They'll talk about how horrible people are, and these are people over here doing these outrageous things in order to say, "Look, I care." And God's saying, that's not the way you show you care. That's not the way you show you understand. You don't have to do that. Just talk to me. God will talk to you about anything. If there's something about God that you don't understand, He's more than happy to talk to you about it. If there's something that really bothers you about God. If you're a sensitive person, there's things in the Bible about God that will trouble you. If you're a sensitive person, you won't be satisfied with the pat answers. If you're a sensitive person, it should make you a little uncomfortable that a loving God will punish people. If you're a sensitive person and you read the Old Testament and God occasionally tells them to go wipe out some town or something, it should trouble you a little bit. There's nothing wrong with not feeling like you've got a satisfactory pat answer to that. And God is very happy to talk to you about it. What God really doesn't want you to do is sit and chit-chat about it with the three stooges like Job's been doing all this time, because they don't have the answers. What God really wants is for you to trust Him. "Yes, I am there. I may not be able to give you the answer that you wanted, but I will give you what you needed. I will help you if you let me do it, if you come directly to me to do it." And he gives Job kind of a satirical challenge, a very gently satirical challenge. He says, verse 9, "Do you have an arm like God's? Can your voice thunder like His? Then adorn yourself with glory and splendor, and clothe yourself in honor and majesty. Unleash the fury of your wrath. Look at every proud man and bring him low. Look at every proud man and humble him. Crush the wicked where they stand." In other words, Job, can you take care of all the problems of the world? Do you have the wisdom and the strength to do it? And Job, of course, realizes, no, I don't. And so it's a very gentle yet satirical challenge to Job, saying, you don't have to judge me, but I'm very happy to answer your questions. We'll talk. We'll talk anytime you want. Have a little confidence in me and then come to me and let me explain these things to you. And he's telling Job basically to keep their relationship on the proper terms. And it's always valuable. We can ask God any question that we want, as long as we understand who God is and don't treat him like a punching bag or just a human celebrity that we can sit back and judge. There's an old story about Napoleon Bonaparte when he had taken over as the ruler of France. And Napoleon took over during the French Revolution when there was a lot of sentiment in France amongst the influential opinion makers to stamp out faith in God, to convince people that the Bible was foolish and to convince people not to go to church and to convince people that Christianity was a lot of nonsense. Now, Napoleon had a lot of faults, but that wasn't one of them. And so he was met early in his time as ruler of France by a delegation of important French officials who'd been out in this one province trying to persuade the people that religion was silly and they should live by scientific principles, and they were trying to say, we got new ways of doing things now. And they were complaining to Napoleon, these ignorant citizens of this province, they don't listen to us when we talk about science. They don't listen to us when we tell them that we've proved that God doesn't exist. They don't listen to us when we prove to them that church is silly. They all they want to do is read their Bible and go to church. And what can we do about it, Your Majesty? Tell us what to do. And Napoleon said, well, if you want them to listen to you instead of listening to the Bible, why don't you try getting crucified and then raising from the dead 3 days later? That'll impress them. And it's kind of a satirical way of saying, yeah, there's a reason why they listen to Jesus and not to you. It's because Jesus is God. And it's kind of for all that Napoleon was one of the champion cynics of our time, there's some valuable truth to that, is that instead of being so impressed with human wisdom, or in a lot of cases, because I know you characters, getting upset about human experts and human opinion makers who say things that you don't think are right and you worry about, isn't someone going to straighten everything out, just have some faith in God. Jesus raised from the dead. God created the universe. He can take care of these things. If it's not urgent to him, it doesn't have to be such a worrisome thing to you. And so in the last part of the chapter, God talks about unleashing his power. And he has these two images that sadly have become theological proving grounds for every armchair theologian who thinks he can come up with a clever theory that distracts people from the real purpose. He talks about the behemoth and the leviathan. And if you read the commentators, they waste a lot of time and chop down a lot of trees to try to prove to you that they know better than everyone else what these are. Simply, we don't know exactly what they are anymore, but they were not meant to be obscure. The behemoth, the image of a behemoth is a powerful land creature, some powerful herbivorous creature who doesn't care about any predators and doesn't worry about anything, just stomps around wherever he wants to go. Some commentators think that that's a hippo. Some commentators think it's an elephant. Some commentators think it must just be a mythical beast. If you read the details, they can't literally apply to any animal living or extinct, and they don't really even apply to any mythical beast. So the image of it, regardless of what the literal meaning was supposed to be, is simply talking about God's power on earth. That this behemoth, if you want to associate him with a powerful creature of some kind, if you want to associate it with God's power in general way, it's talking about that God's power can be expressed in any way that God feels like it, in any way that God finds appropriate. And it's not an arbitrary God. He's saying, God is trying to teach Job that I have all this power, but I use it in a particular way. I don't just use it arbitrarily. I'm not going to just come down every time someone says something foolish and straighten them out. I'm not just going to come down every time someone does something sinful and punish them. I'm going to use it in a way that furthers my real purpose, which is to know you and draw you to me. Another old story about Martha Washington, George Washington's wife. She one time sat down with him at dinner and said, you know, George, I was talking to a couple people today, this man who actually really likes you, you know, but what he said about you, he said, you have an absolutely terrible temper. And George Washington started to get real red, and he said, oh, he did. What else did he say? And Martha said, but then he said, but you know, he has it under tremendous control. And this is kind of what God is trying to tell Job. This is what God is trying to tell Job is, yes, Job, I have tremendous power. If I wanted to, I could slap everybody around and blow everything up. But I don't want to, because I love you guys. I even love your goofball friends. I don't want to hurt them. I don't want to hurt you. I never would have hurt you deliberately. I care about you. Just believe that and trust that about me. I do have all this power, but I'm going to use it in my own way. The image of the Leviathan, which I just have to kind of abridge here. Leviathan, by commentators, is sometimes associated with a crocodile, which is probably partially true because the Nile crocodile in Job's time and place was a tremendously feared animal. They ate a lot of human beings. They were the subject of a lot of myths. So a lot of the fanciful images at the end of chapter 41, they don't apply in any literal way to a crocodile, but it could have represented things people believed about a crocodile. It doesn't have to be, though, again, a literal creature. The basic significance of the Leviathan is, again, not any literal creature, but God's power in the depths, because it talks about the Leviathan, this creature that lives in or near the water, slithering around the water and having the power to go anywhere he wants in the hidden depths where no one can see it and no one can get at it. And it's kind of a way of saying that, yeah, Job, sometimes I express my power very openly, like the behemoth, whatever this big creature is, lumbering around, stomping around, and no one can do anything. Sometimes I express my power in the depths. Sometimes I express my power in the hidden places where no one can see. And you know, that is true, again, scientifically, and you engineers can bear me out on this. There are hidden aspects of God's creation that occasionally you see in science and in practical learning where God has done something outstanding that he doesn't feel a need to show off. There are very obscure creatures that hardly anybody except nature freaks like me know about that show some incredible imagination and resourcefulness on God's part. There are natural laws that you engineers research and study and know a lot more about than I do, where you're simply using the things that God has built into the world. And so this is what God is telling Job also. Sometimes my power is shown in the depths. Sometimes my power is woven deeply into the fabric of my creation where you're probably not ever going to find it, but it's still there. And you can trust me on that. And so what God is giving Job is a very respectful but firm reassurance of who he is and a call for Job to trust him and understand him. And Job accepts it. That brief little statement we saw back in chapter 40 and much more when we'll see next week. Job gets it. He understands it. He realizes, I didn't get any of my questions answered. This isn't what I expected, but I get it. I'm going to trust God now. Here's where we come in with our trivia for the week. We have President's Trivia this week. Did you know that there was a United States president who was given the oath of office by his own father? So which U.S. president was given the oath of office by his own father? Was it John Quincy Adams? Was it William Howard Taft? And Frieda's not here this week for you to everyone look and see who she picked. Was it Calvin Coolidge? Was it John Kennedy? Or was it Lyndon Johnson? Well, the year was 1923. Now, does that help you out? Janet would know, wouldn't she? Janet has all the presidents memorized. 1923, the president in 1923 was Warren Harding. And he was on a trip out to the West Coast and he became very ill suddenly and he died. And so his vice president was Calvin Coolidge. And Calvin Coolidge was visiting his father in Vermont, in the old farmhouse where he had grown up. He'd taken a little trip to go up to this little town, Plymouth Notch, Vermont, and was visiting his dad in the old farmhouse where he had grown up. And so it took him several hours to find the vice president and tell him that he should be the president. And there wasn't even a phone in this old farmhouse where Coolidge's dad lived. And so they finally tracked down Coolidge and a couple of reporters came. They finally placed a call to the general store in the area there. And a couple of local reporters, trotted over to the Coolidge farm and talked to Coolidge's dad. And Coolidge had gone to bed already. And they said, well, your son's president now. So his dad went and woke him up. And his dad said, well, looks like we're going to have a long night here, so I'll get some coffee and everything ready for people. And Coolidge trotted down to the general store, had him put in a phone call to Washington to the Secretary of State to find out what to do first. And so he talked to the Secretary of State, and the Secretary of State said, well, the first thing you need to do is you need to get sworn into office. You need to have someone give you the oath of office. So, you know, see if you can find, you know, maybe there's a Vermont State Supreme Court judge or, you know, someone, you know, the Attorney General of Vermont or something like that. See what you can find. And Coolidge says, well, we don't have too many important people around here. How about my dad? He's a notary public. And the Secretary of State thought about it and said, you know, a notary public is good enough. It's good enough. And so he went back home and said, Dad, get out the old Bible. And they had a little ceremony right there with Coolidge and his dad and a couple of reporters. And they didn't even have electricity in the little farmhouse, so they had this old kerosene lamp to read the oath of office by. And so that's so Coolidge is the answer. Coolidge's dad actually got in a little bit of hot water because Coolidge's mother passed away when he was much younger, and so his father had two women who were old friends of the family who lived in his farmhouse as his housekeepers, and he didn't want to bother them, so he didn't wake them up. And so the next morning they woke up and found out that young Cal had been sworn in as president, and old John didn't even have the courtesy to wake him up and let him watch it, so they were kind of annoyed about that. But what they really got upset about is the paper came, and it talked about, you know, the big local event here, and it said, it had a line in the paper's report. It said, John Coolidge swore in his son Calvin by the light of an old greasy kerosene lamp. And that really upset these two housekeepers, and they demanded that John Coolidge insist that the paper print a retraction that it was not greasy. Well, the simple point that I want to make is, you know, Calvin Coolidge was told, go find someone important to swear you in, and he just said, how about my dad? My dad's good enough for me. He's the most important man in my life. And that's a very simple but appropriate sentiment for all our problems and all our worries and all the things that trouble us, which they should. There's nothing wrong if you're a faithful believer. There's nothing wrong with being troubled by the things in this world. There's nothing wrong with even being troubled by some of the things God does. God can be very mysterious. The right thing to do is not to go around looking for human experts, convening a panel of Eliphazes and Bildads and Zophars. Talk to God about it. Let it out with God. Let God know how troubled you are, and then listen for God to answer. God will not answer in the way you expect, but he does care about you. He may not answer in the time and place you expect. It won't be in the way you expect, but he does care about you. He wants you to know. So just ask yourself, how about your dad in heaven when you have trouble? Let him be the first person you go to. Certainly he'll use humans. He'll use a lot of other things. But the point that God is making to Job is just remember, always come to me first. Always think of me first, because I'm your dad. I love you more than these other people do, and I've got a lot of things that I can do to help you to understand things. Thank you very much. Once again, doing very well with the time here. This was what the NCAA likes to call a point of emphasis this year. Yeah. So we're letting you go on time, and we'll see you next week.